And the right wing jumps in with like a set of answers that like seem very persuasive. And I was wholly persuaded, thankfully, was just beleaguering people with long emails to the tune of fives or tens of people. And unfortunately, this kid is going through this process in front of an audience of hundreds of thousands.
Hello, and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. I am Rory McElhone. In charge of podcasting and in charge of politics is Robert Morris. How are you keeping this time?
Not bad, not bad. I actually saw something pretty cool, Rory, and I think at the outset of what is likely to be rather a negative episode, I think it might be fun to mention house prices in Austin, Texas.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Dune 2, but anyway.
We can talk about Dune 2 if you want. I enjoyed Dune 2. It was fun. Have you seen it?
Were any worms being ridden in Texas?
I don't know. They do. Everything's bigger in Texas.
Okay.
So if there are sandworms, then they're probably bigger in Texas. Do you remember that movie with Kevin Bacon, Tremors?
Yes.
Does that ring a bell? Was that based in Texas? Maybe those are Texas sandworms.
I'm not sure. It's sort of like undescript sort of rural America.
Editing Rory here. Tremors is set in Nevada.
Yeah, I haven't seen that film in easily a quarter century.
Yeah, the first one is good, but they do keep releasing them until they stop becoming profitable.
Yeah, so diminishing returns. Well, I love Dune. That was a lot of fun. But
so tell me all about the house prices.
So apparently rental prices in Austin, Texas are crashing. And I haven't done an in-depth dive here, but the math seems pretty simple. The formula seems pretty simple. And we've now seen it in a very blue state, and we've seen it in a very red state. And it's just simple supply and demand. If you build sufficient housing, probably by the metrics of landlords or homeowners, excessive amounts of housing, then the rents fall. And it's a really simple piece of math that a lot of people in the United States are really, really invested in not acknowledging. And it's nice to see. In recent years, we've seen in the state of Washington, the city of Seattle has really, really, really built out a ton of stuff. And there were some minor falls in rental prices, nearly uniquely in the country. And now it's becoming clear that Austin is seeing significantly larger falls in the cost of housing simply because they build enough housing.
Is it true that Texas has a policy where they're more likely to give homeless people homes, which dramatically reduces homelessness?
Yes, I believe. Well, so it's not, I don't believe it's statewide. I think it's Houston specifically has really emphasized the housing first approach. And of course, like this housing crisis is intimately, deeply, directly connected to homelessness in the United States. This also makes sense, yet there are a lot of people who are really invested in trying to avoid this simple connection. If housing costs are less insane, you will have fewer homeless. Texas has fewer homeless because their housing costs are less insane, and they have, it varies from locality to locality, but they have a much deeper and more serious commitment to building enough housing.
Is Texas, although it's still one of the, you know, Colossus states, is it still trying to like attract people? So it sort of, you know, values people as opposed to other states that feel like they're rich enough, so they don't really care about the people at the bottom?
It's a generalization, but I think it would be fair to say that Texas is very much in the, there are more Texans who are very much in the, come on down, let's get bigger camp than there are Californians in that camp. I think there's certainly plenty of Californians who want more company, want to build their state, but there's also a significant and probably more than in Texas populations of, well, if you can't afford to be here, you don't belong here, and that sort of thing. Whereas California, say, in the mid-20th century was much more of a state that was interested in attracting people.
Yeah, because I've heard it sort of compared to, it's like a sort of a young California. It's still, you know, got a lot of vigor and wants to attract people and be dynamic, while California has already made its wealth, so it's a bit in a hoarding gold like a dragon phase.
Well, there is a landed aristocracy in California, as I like to say. There's a lot of people in California who don't have to work because their parents bought a property or two in the 1950s. But I mean, that can be overblown as well. I mean, California is actually making some pretty serious strides on fixing some of their housing problems. And it's getting better there as well. But it's just really important to emphasize that, yes, if you build more buildings, the prices will go down.
It's too much. You need to show the work on it. It doesn't make any sense to me, Rob.
I know. It's crazy, crazy to say that. Somehow, everybody who buys a house gets really invested in finding really complicated ways why that doesn't, that's not true. Because, of course,
house pricing in your lovely state of New York getting on?
Oh, it remains insane.
Oh, okay.
And there's tons of people in New York who'll tell you, it's like, see, we've been building like crazy ever since Bloomberg and prices are still high. And then if you like sort of do the math, like building like crazy is like a fraction of what we were building in the 40s, 50s, or 60s.
Because there's a trail, a lot of these like mega apartments that are like, you know, multi-million dollar apartments are like vacant because they just buy them as an asset.
I think that's overstated.
Okay.
But what's not overstated is the problems related to what developers want to build. I think some of this is libertarian claptrap. Some of this is developers BSing or something. But I think it is really true that regulatory burdens are so high in New York, and it is so difficult for, it is legitimately actually difficult for landlords compared to most other jurisdictions. So the only thing that it makes sense for developers and landlords to build are these luxury accommodations.
But isn't it good Trump came in and fixed all of these issues?
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it was a magical, magical time in the United States between 2017 and 2021. Absolutely nothing went wrong. Everything was great. It's only really when Biden came in that problems were reinvented, which is, of course, more or less the topic of today's discussion. Over the past week or so, I've been very intensely writing a script, shooting a script, editing together a script on what if alt-hist. This is a little niche, but if you'll bear with us, we're mostly going to be talking about something of much wider application, which is Trump's foreign policy. But there is this YouTuber named What If Alt-Hist, and after years of people begging me to do it, 3 or 4 years ago, I did a critique of What If Alt-Hist. It did surprisingly
well. I
find
it to be a very personal critique, because you're sort of saying that you've seen a lot of yourself in him. And
oh, for sure.
You could have seen him yourself going down that route if, things had gone slightly different. So it was almost like you were sort of the elder statesman trying to help him.
Well, I did go down that route. There just wasn't a YouTube when I was his age. This is a very young kid, though we were talking before the podcast. He seems to be aging a little more slowly than...
Yeah, he's 22, but he must have just started from, what, 15 or something?
There was some question as to whether he's really quite that young, because I feel like I made the other two videos on What If Alt-Hist 2 years ago, and he was 21, and now it's 2 years later, and he's 22, so he seems, I don't know, perhaps there's some... perhaps it's just the way the calendar's
working. Maybe he's been following what we'll talk about in our next podcast and how to slow down time so he ages slower.
Yes, perhaps that's it. Perhaps that's why. I think if you keep the scheduling in mind to really mess with people's sense of time, actually, that'll be the last podcast. Remember, Rick?
Yes, exactly.
There we go. What If Alt-Hist is a sort of right-wing YouTuber. I don't know. I think some would object to describe him as sort of alt-right.
He's definitely flirting with it, like Joe Rogan's often criticized for sort of introducing some of the sort of more far-right, but I don't think, you know, Joe himself would be far-right, but the maps this man produces do, I definitely would suggest he flirts with the idea a lot.
Well, it's interesting because the subject matter he delves into is primarily like history and geopolitics, and the sources that he uses are just generally pretty... Well, they're either quite nuts, sort of Oswald Spengler, the decline of the West, you know, sort of classical, sort of right wing big history, or they're just like the standard Republican resources. And it's interesting because he sort of represents, at least he used to be very anti Donald Trump, very anti alt right specifically, or some personalities that describe themselves as alt right. Yet what he was using as historical sources are the kinds of historical sources that most Republicans would have liked. And it just sort of becomes clear that when you dive into the topic of like the history that most Republicans like, it's all pretty alt-right. It's all pretty racist curious. It's all pretty anti-feminist. It's all pretty grim.
Yeah, strangely a big anti-women thing in it, which I wasn't expecting.
Yes, that is emphasized in my video that should definitely be out by the time this podcast is up. And it's definitely gotten more so. So this kid convinced to look into his stuff, and I think it was back in 2022, I did two videos on What If Alt Hist that were quite successful, though now they finally passed 100,000 views, revisiting 2 years later. And I definitely identify like a sort of a higher pitch of sort of franticness and definitely much closer to, I mean, now that sort of the divisions between alt-right and right and whatnot seem to have fallen apart, it's all just sort of MAGA Trumpiness now. I guess he doesn't seem to be standing up for any kind of older way of looking at things anymore. He just sort of seems kind of Trumpy. Which is sort of the main thing about What If Alt Hist that I want to talk about today is a list that he put together at the end of a video he put together on the prospect of U.S.-Iran war. And this list is a list of illustrations, a list of 10 illustrations of why Donald Trump had the best foreign policy of any president in recent decades.
Well, it's always good to start a war with China. So we have to at least give Trump that.
Yeah. Well, but the thing is, you don't, Rory. That's the thing. You don't. And I think that whether or not we think stepped up hostility towards China is a good thing, I think it's pretty clear to me that that didn't start with Donald Trump. That started with Barack Obama. It was, over the 8 years that Obama was in power, there was a progressive heightening of tensions with China, very consciously and led by the White House, by the presidential administration. What Trump did was he came in and he made everything just a little more crazy and a little more unstable. There were aspects of things that Trump did that were more hostile towards China in different ways, like the straight up trade war, which is something that Biden has adopted and expanded. That was relatively novel. The way that Barack Obama wanted to do that was through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. There are a lot of good reasons to complain about the TPP. I was an opponent of the TPP back in 2015. I think somewhat uniquely, I was an opponent of the TPP because I thought it was unfair to China and unfair to Africa and unfair to all of these other developing countries that we had convinced to join the World Trade Organization. And then the TPP was just like, oh, here's a smaller club that, provides more benefits and does not provide any benefits to all those people who sacrificed so much to join the World Trade Organization. But the whole point of the TPP, so you could oppose the TPP because it was unfair to the people who had sacrificed so much to join the WTO. You could object to the TPP because it had insufficient protections for labor rights. You can object to the TPP because there's a mechanism that I think has since been stripped from it by which countries are forced into arbitration with companies. So like if like a multinational company comes in, then the countries can't just make laws about what's happening.
Yeah, I think I remember hearing that being one of the most controversial parts of it. Basically, if you've introduced a law that negatively affects profits, you can be taken to court over it.
You can be taken to like binding arbitration, which is even worse than court, because if it was court, like, okay, where? Like, well, it's going to be court in our country, right? So we've obviously got, our laws are what matters. No. If you put in a law that hurts a company, then you have to go do arbitration in Switzerland with a bunch of lawyers that most likely work for that company when they're not sitting on that arbitral panel. So yeah, there were definitely bad things about the TPP. But you have to understand that the TPP is like a hundreds of pages document. And in that hundreds of pages of document, it essentially was an attempt to much more politely, much more sort of delicately slide the knife in, do the same thing that the Trump tariffs are doing. Just to do it more subtly without the brouhaha, without the thuggishness, without the nastiness, without the idiocy of the Trump approach. So I think the TPP, as I said, I opposed it at the time. But if our goal really was to push China out of the trading system or lever how China is able to act in the trading system, I think the TPP would have been a better way to do it than this sort of catch-all, very sort of sledgehammer approach of the Trump tariffs. We are now doing the Trump tariffs, but it seems strange to me to say that, Donald Trump came up with our anti-China program when we started that anti-China program with the pivot to Asia back in 2012. So yeah, but I think that is sort of like the standard view is like, oh, Trump changed our foreign policy with regards to China. And no, he really, really didn't.
But has America ever been like pro-China in the past 50 years? Like it's always sort of been somewhat skeptical and manipulating and, you know, it's like it's created its own beast to attack.
The relationship between China and the United States was set in the 1970s. There was no relationship between 1949 and, I mean, barring backdoor stuff and give and take between the late 1940s and the early 1970s. The start to the relationship that set the relationship on a positive path that probably wouldn't have been possible otherwise was the Cold War, was the fact that Nixon and Kissinger were very consciously carving China off its alliance with Russia, with the Soviet Union. And we could already see this, you know, that this was an obvious opportunity that only Nixon could take advantage of. Only Nixon could go to China because he was so rabidly right-wing. I think from the 1960s, the late 1960s, the Soviet Union and China were fighting like border conflicts or and whatnot. And there's, I think, is this great. You told me about this,
is
right?
Is it the Chairman Mao quote about the if they went to war that it's okay, we have 600 million and we'd only have 300 million left.
Well, no, there was this I think the Soviets actually approached Washington D.C. With a question at some point in the 60s or 70s, like, would you mind terribly if we wiped Beijing off the face of the map? Like a sort of a so it was clear that this was an opportunity, and especially in the aftermath of the mess that we had made in Vietnam, closer U.S.-Chinese relations seemed like an easy win, and they were. From the 70s and through the 80s, there was a lot of economic openness. In the 90s and in the aughts, that was replaced, inadequately replaced, with the economic benefit that U.S. multinationals were getting, both the cheap labor that China offered and the prospects of a brand new market for these multinationals' goods.
But if there's sweatshops there, then there'll be democracy?
Yes, yes. And I believe in that, honestly. I think actually that China still is on a massively more democratic path than it was. Really, I mean, I think that's worth highlighting. I mean, Xi Jinping is taking China in a bad direction, but even at this point, I would argue, with the exception of Hong Kong, probably Xinjiang, China is in a more democratic place now today than it was at any point under Deng Xiaoping, even though Deng Xiaoping was definitely moving things in a good direction. I'm quite convinced that Xi Jinping would not be the figure that he is, would not be able to have turned himself into a president for life the way he has without U.S. aggression. So I think those two things are connected. But anyway, to answer your question, I think by the 2016 election, for sure, and earlier than that, for a lot of people in Washington, D.C., it was clear that the benefits that the United States was getting from cheap labor and market access were not as good as having a billion-person ally against the Soviet Union. And I think I sort of railed against it, but with the distance of time, I think some kind of switch in U.S.-Chinese relations evolution was inevitable. But it didn't have to be this aggressive. It didn't have to be this much about Taiwan. It didn't have to be creating this much risk of World War III.
But you have to give them credit for, you know, getting on well with the Saudis and the Turks.
So this would be the second item on What If Altist's list. The relationship with Saudi Arabia and Turkey, and I mean, What If Altist, this right-wing YouTuber, provides this ludicrous, provides this ludicrous map of the Middle East saying, these are the places we were allied with under Trump. These are the places we're not allied with under Biden. And it's just like...
Yes, because so much has changed.
Nothing has changed. Like, nothing has changed. It's not like Saudi Arabia isn't buying weapons from us.
And Saudi Arabia is buying all your golfers.
Yes, and apparently trying to buy our tennis players now as well.
Yes, it's gone a bit sports crazy.
It's very diamond necklace affair to me for the French Revolution heads. I remain convinced that Saudi Arabia, we're in the last 5 to 10 years of this Saudi
So are you saying
approach.
That if the money came your way, you'd take it because they're going to be gone in a couple of years? So it's not really that bad.
I mean, I don't know what. More Freedom Foundation sponsored by Saudi Arabia.
Oh my goodness! No,
what would that even look like? It's just, by the way,
I think we might go to an embassy and then not come out of it.
Yeah. I mean, just by the way, turns out I'm not actually angry about 9/11 anymore. It's a long time ago. Long time ago. It's fine.
Oh yeah. I wonder how often that pivot has happened in media, where suddenly someone's very like, oh, those Saudis are suddenly fantastic, and I think they're incredible.
Well, as What If Altist would not acknowledge, Joe Biden has very much made that pivot. He famously, on the campaign trail, was going to make Saudi Arabia a pariah because of Khashoggi and Yemen. Of course, now we're bombing Yemen. He, I think, rather quickly sort of turned on a dime and has been did very, very little against Saudi Arabia. I mean, they are a U.S. client state. It is the same as it was under Trump, as it is under Biden. So Trump is the guy who was president when they dismembered a Washington Post journalist. Donald Trump was the president when they were trying to do a Putin-esque takeover.
Well, sadly, they do stuff like this all the time, but, you know, the West at large only really cared when it was a, you know, Washington Post journalist.
Well, what's interesting is that actually Saudi Arabia has been dramatically better mannered under Biden than it has been under Trump.
Okay, interesting.
So I think the big narrative has been that, oh gosh, you know, they're really making fun of Biden and insulting him. But honestly, like, MBS is an infinitely calmer, more manageable actor under Biden than he was under Trump. It is absolutely true that Donald Trump was very close to Saudi Arabia. He was bought by Saudi Arabia.
But that's what they do. If they don't kill you, they buy you.
Indeed. Yemen wasn't the only country that Saudi Arabia was interested in invading. They wanted to invade Qatar because Qatar sponsors Al Jazeera, independent news channel, as long as it's not talking about Qatar.
Yes. Well, I think it's probably one of the better ones, and it's definitely very good for, you know, a worldwide breadth, but just every news source has its bias, and definitely.
Well, and you have to understand, Rory, is Qatar is so small. So actually, Al Jazeera has a, 99.9% of the world's surface. Al Jazeera is a better news source on. Whereas you can't trust CNN for anything related to U.S. empire.
Yeah.
So you really can't trust CNN or BBC for anything. So Al Jazeera is actually a much more worthwhile news source. And that was the main reason why MBS was so interested in straight up invading Qatar in 2017. Got the minutia of this is hard to parse. It was sort of behind closed doors. But the sense I have is that Donald Trump pretty much gave him the go-ahead. And then the Secretary of Defense, Mattis at the time, and Secretary of State at the time, Rex Tillerson, the Exxon guy, had to be like, what the hell are you doing? There is a U.S. base with 10,000 soldiers in Qatar. And this is not, we do not allow, you know, petroleum dictators to invade their smaller neighbors. Like, that's the whole, you know, one of the main justifications why we're there in the first place is because Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in the early 1990s. So basically,
even though there was a lot more justification for that than what Saudi Arabia was planning.
I mean, I'm not entirely, I don't think Iraq's invasion of Kuwait was justified.
Yeah, I'm just saying I can understand it a lot more because didn't Britain divide it up? So Iraq would have worked with that part of Kuwait, and then that would have acted as its port to the world.
You know, Rory, I'm not honestly certain.
I'm not justifying it, but I can see why it happened more so than Saudi Arabia.
It was certainly a longer standing claim.
Yes.
Than that I can say with great confidence. So this almost happened in 2017, like a Saudi invasion of Qatar. Instead, they had to settle for, I think they like dredged a canal or something, you know, like literally cut Qatar off from Saudi Arabia. Like, so basically Saudi Arabia during the Trump administration was a effing rogue state. You know, remember they kidnapped president or prime minister of Lebanon and made him resign. That was kind of a weird move. Yeah. So Saudi Arabia under the Trump administration was a rogue state because it had purchased a president. Saudi Arabia under Joe Biden is attempting to make peace with its neighbors. It's being quieter. It's, you know, trying to prop up the oil price, which U.S. politicians on the campaign trail have to be like, oh, no, that's terrible. But seeing as how the United States is a petrostate now is actually something that...
They just count all their money.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
But at least he took us out of trade deals.
Yes, of course. Donald Trump took us out of trade deals. The problem is, can you think of any? Can you name one?
No. But the strange thing is, you never want to leave a trade deal. You essentially want more and more trade. So that's why, you know, if you look at what countries were trading 100 years ago, they just slowly add up and add up and add up. And generally, that's why trade deals take so long, because you're you know, sacrificing something of yourself to gain something from someone else. But you never want to reduce a trade deal, unless it's Brexit, where you'd sort of go a bit mad.
Well, yes. And that Brexit has, of course, been a famous success for the British, as Trump heavily endorsed Brexit at the time. It's worked out really well for everybody.
Do Americans really care? Because I feel like it's just something to sort of say, like, oh, we're giving the establishment a punch in the nose, and Brexit's just like a thing that gets shouted out and then quickly forgotten.
I mean, do Americans care about Brexit?
Yeah.
No.
No. That's what I thought.
I don't think the 2% of Americans who have any idea what Brexit is or was, I just sort of probably see it as a cautionary tale.
You do see Trump like say it occasionally, and then it gets a bit of a cheer, and then he's on to the next talking point.
I think probably for some of Donald Trump's more attentive partisans, the idea that certain right-wing British politicians and the idea of Brexit as sort of our team, you know, might connect. But I think, honestly, I've heard a lot less of that kind of language. I mean, does Nigel Farage still show up at CPAC? Or
what's interesting is he's left, his party sort of become the Reform Party, and because they don't know when the UK election is, there's a theory that he isn't joining the Reform Party because he's waiting to see when the election is, because he doesn't want to miss out on all the Trump money that he could by going to Trump rallies.
Oh, wow. Well, it would be interesting to see is whether or not Nigel Farage is still welcome, because I think the growing consensus is that Brexit is a bet that hasn't really worked out so well.
Well, the idea was that America would get a really, you know, generous trade deal and be able to gobble up the NHS, things like that, which hasn't quite come to fruition.
Yeah, I think what Trump certainly symbolized is an era of no new trade deals. It's clear, I think, I can't recall the exact details of this, but I seem to recall that on the campaign trail, at least, even Hillary Clinton was disowning the TPP.
Mm-hmm.
To be clear, so one of Trump's first actions was to derail the TPP when he came into power. But that is not a trade deal that had been signed. Like, that is a trade deal that had not been ratified, had not come into effect. So he certainly did stop that trade deal, but he did not. But there's some question as to whether Clinton would have. I mean, she said she wouldn't have. Clinton said something doesn't necessarily mean it's, you know, maybe she would have gone forward with it. But it's clear now, and Trump certainly symbolizes this, that we are in an era of no new trade deals, unless there's some geopolitical significance that can be attached to them. There's something that's sticking in my, there was something that Biden did, but it's not necessarily, full on World Trade Organization, TPP, full-on FTA, you know, free trade agreements, even bilaterally, I think are pretty much not happening under Trump or Biden. I think that there's a lot of parts to that, but I think there's primarily is the sense that the American working class got burned by the China shock. So I think probably in the long, long term, in the 2030s, 2040s, we'll probably get back onto a further integration on trade of the world. But I think the consensus is, not just in the United States, that why don't we just take a pause here?
But it's also, a lot of these trade deals do take like 10 years to make. So it's quite often things are still happening, but it might take a long time for it to be finalized.
Well, and the thing is they're becoming infinitely more complex now. With the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and with the WTO, you know, what you think of as trade deals, which is just sort of like, oh, well, okay, you'll go down X percent on that tariff and I'll go down 3% on that tariff. And then most of that has been done. There are still And there are more now tariffs being reintroduced, but largely, I believe, by the Clinton administration. You know, most of that, the tariff stuff was done. What's now important to developed world economies is much more fiendishly complex stuff, like what is your internet governance going to be? What is your approach to subsidizing industry within your own country? And can we harmonize that across our economy? So fundamentally, these trade deals, and I think I don't want to be sounding too sort of willy-eyed or right-wing here, but they are essentially about parceling out pieces of sovereignty. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, but it is a significant thing. And I think it's entirely reasonable for there to be a decade or two pause while we sort out the ramifications of the things that have already been signed. So I don't think that's necessarily such a bad thing. And I think certainly the United States, Europe to a lesser but growing degree, and other countries are interested in saying, well, maybe we're gonna dial back a little bit. I think the objection to that, every, you know, national governments have to go to arbitration if they offend Coca-Cola in Switzerland a bit. I think people were right to be bothered by that. You know, maybe there's scope for a more democratically appropriate arbitral system in Switzerland to be built. But that's something that needs to be built up over time. One of the most interesting stories about facts about the WTO is that, so the WTO is a framework that goes back to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. That's in the aftermath of World War II. It steadily grew from a bunch of rich European countries, primarily in Japan, to the whole world by the 1990s. It really was the World Trade Organization with just a few. I mean, interestingly, I don't think Russia joined until probably a year before Putin invaded Ukraine, near universal. And I think one of the dynamics here, the reason why the United States and the Obama administration decided to move away from this everybody all together framework into these smaller, oh, we're going to do the Trans-Pacific partnership with a handpicked group of countries, and then we're going to do the Transatlantic partnership with a handpicked group of countries, was basically that the developing world countries that had been initially just happy to be part of the club had developed too much expertise. Essentially, they'd figured out the system. There were some big cases, I think, in the early aughts, where like Brazil was able to win a World Trade Organization proceeding against the United States. And the United States is like, wait a second, maybe we don't like this so much.
Because I've heard this is what's also bandied against China, which is it didn't take these institutions as granted. It, you know, worked hard in them. It signed enough deals. It made enough friends and figured out how they worked. And then America was like, oh, China's taking over the world when actually it's just trying to be a bit fairer.
Yeah, basically, the United States and Europe pieced out of the World Trade Organization. I think we're all still technically there, though I don't think Trump or Biden has been reappointing judges to certain arbitral tribunals. But basically, the U.S. and Europe pieced out of the World Trade Organization at the point at which the poor countries figured out how to use the rules, which is pretty gross, frankly.
But at least Trump forced the European countries to spend their 2% of NATO defense spending.
That was pretty amazing. Yeah, you have to see that, of course, for a, you know, during the Trump administration, they must have hit all their requirements.
Oh, yeah. They certainly all did exactly at least 2%. And Poland maybe ran way ahead.
Sure. In 4 years into the Biden, 3 years into the Biden administration, 2 years into a Russian invasion of Ukraine, I still don't believe anybody in Western Europe is hitting their 2%. Is that?
I'm sure some are. I think. Well, yeah, Western Europe. I'm trying to think.
Yeah, but Poland and the Baltics, looking quite closely, you know, feeling very close to Russia. My understanding is they have, at least since the invasion and probably before, have been running at 2% or in excess of their requirements. I think some of the Nordics actually have always been in compliance, maybe.
Well, yeah, because they also had
Well, they weren't NATO,
Russia on their,
but yeah.
Yeah, and some have just recently joined.
The big countries, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, I don't think they've ever met their 2%. Or rather, not since the Cold War have they met their 2% requirements. Donald Trump talked about it a lot. Barack Obama talked about it a lot. Joe Biden talks about it a lot. And it continues to not happen.
But
so
one country is spending more than America, apparently, which is Greece, at 3.58%.
Really?
Yes.
My gosh. And I think that was it. There was some news story I saw recently. There was some insult or perhaps a murder, I can't recall, that was related to a Russian. So they instantly funded Ukraine quite generously, which seems very...
So yes, the member states that spend over 2% seem to be Greece, United States, Lithuania, Poland, United Kingdom, Estonia, and Latvia.
Yeah, so it is the Baltics, the UK.
I thought Turkey would have been in there. I'm surprised
Turkey
at
doesn't
that.
Spend over 2%. Is that EU or
not? Not NATO member states. The spending 2022.
My God, so it's 2022. So that would be the year maybe there's another state or two that's above that now. But anyway, 2022, and it's not like it was better under the Trump administration. This is...
The countries that met the 2% criteria for NATO membership in 2023 were Poland, United States, Greece, Estonia, Lithuania, Finland, Romania, Hungary, Latvia, United Kingdom, and Slovakia.
De-emphasizing the Middle Eastern strategy... would be the next, which is, again, I'm just like, what?
But it's great that Trump has de-emphasized the Middle East in strategy. Isn't that a great thing that's been achieved?
Good God. It's just, what, like, where was this kid just asleep during the Trump administration? Like, well, I mean, gosh, I guess he was, if you do the math, I guess he was...
He couldn't drink in America?
No.
But when did he write this?
Well, this is a video from earlier this year.
Yeah, so it's after October?
Yes, I believe it's after October.
I did see his response was basically, America has nothing to do with this, and I don't know why people are getting interested. And I was just what planet is he living in?
There's a serious disconnect between what's actually happening and what a lot of online right-wing discussion involves. But just to recount, you may recall, he actually mentions, I think elsewhere in this video, mentions the fact that Donald Trump decided to haul off and assassinate, one of the most powerful people in Iran on a visit to Iraq, in the process also assassinating a highly placed Iraqi government figure, which almost led to the United States getting kicked out of Iraq, which honestly would have been great. But something I keep hoping for. It is bizarre that also we had the Barack Obama did a lot of terrible things in foreign policy. First and foremost, destroying Libya and robbing all of North Africa of a decade of economic development. But the one great thing, the one achievement that he did manage to put together was the beginnings of a peace deal with Iran. This was the Iran nuclear deal, one of the most absurdly one-sided arms limitations treaties in human history. The United States gave up nothing, and Iran agreed to subject itself to humiliating inspections, limitations far beyond those imposed on any other country in the world. But they did this because it was what they felt they needed to do to rejoin the community of nations. This was a foundation upon which the next U.S. president really could have built a U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East. So that's what the JCPOA was, the Iran nuclear deal, was the foundation upon which a real withdrawal from the U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East could have been built. And it took him 2 years to do it because it was so insane that even the people he hired didn't want to do it for him, but he did manage to destroy that foundation. So this idea that he withdrew us from the Middle East somehow by guaranteeing another 6 years, the 6 years that we've had of increased back and forth, restoring deterrence, bombings, sanctions, assassinations with Iran, Yeah, the idea that Trump did anything to take us out of the Middle East is frankly ludicrous.
But you have to have at least give him that he didn't start any wars, which has to be given credit to all American presidents.
Well, that's deeply, deeply debatable, Rory. And I think that, but I think you, as I said in the video, you kind of have to give what if all his partial credit for this, because he didn't start any new wars. He tried to start one with Venezuela. He tried to start one with Iran, but he didn't really actually start any new wars. What he did do was double down in absurd ways on all of the wars we were currently fighting. The Obama administration, in return for Saudi Arabia getting out of the way of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, allowed Saudi Arabia to invade its neighbors. So that is absolutely a war that Obama started. Only 10 months in, towards the end of the Obama administration, he could see that this was a nightmare, and he tried to stop it. He tried to pull back U.S. involvement. For the next 4 years, Donald Trump did everything he could to push the U.S. further into supporting this horrific invasion of Yemen. And really, the only reason that Saudi Arabia's invasion of Yemen stopped is because the Iranians provided enough missile technology to the Yemenis to establish deterrence. And it wasn't actually the United States that ever gave up on invading Yemen. It was Saudi Arabia that gave up on invading Yemen during the Trump administration. Yeah, he didn't start that, but he made it much, much worse. What's interesting about Trump is that he was such a weak figure that he allowed a lot of actors the scope to go do whatever they wanted. And that's within and without the U.S. government. I've talked about, I think probably before, probably recently, about how the U.S. president is potentially really the only governor on the U.S. military-industrial complex. Nominally, the president is in charge of our foreign policy.
Commander-in-chief?
Yeah, commander-in-chief. In practice, what the president is doing, and the reason why George W. Bush's presidency is so damaging, is he didn't do anything. He was not a governor. He was not a let's hold back the violent instincts of the U.S. government. He was like, let's go for it. Donald Trump wasn't a let's go for it. He was actually making a lot of speeches saying, hey, we maybe shouldn't do this. But he was such a absent manager with such like violent and idiotic instincts.
And easily distracted, allegedly.
Yeah, that the military industrial complex was allowed to do essentially whatever it wanted.
It is also terrifying, the idea of the, you know, we keep hearing the term like psyops and stuff, like some of these people doing very basic techniques to basically trick Trump and be able to, you know, have free reign while he's distracted.
And bragging about it. And bragging about it. Two examples I can think of. I think it was Jim Jeffrey, I can't remember if he was the ambassador to Syria or if he was just sort of a general Middle East envoy. Very shortly after Trump got out of office, was like, yeah, we just lied to him about the amount of troops we have there.
Wow.
He's like said that in an interview. Mark Milley got, when he retired, this is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, their terms are intentionally staggered. So like each president gets to appoint one, but then they definitely, unless they, you know, I think have always ended up completing their term well into the office of the next president. So Mark Milley, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, got a sort of worshipful profile in the Atlantic that, of course, opened with a tour of a nuclear weapons facility. Any opportunity to sell U.S. nuclear weapons. But he got the cover story on the Atlantic Monthly, which is sort of the Steve Jobs' widow owns it. It's a 150-year-old. It's where Obama gave his sort of like post, you know, his exit interview.
It's very establishment.
Very establishment. And Mark Milley got a cover story talking about how awesome it was the way that he managed the president.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's quite something. So, yeah, this idea that Donald Trump didn't start wars, he didn't start wars because he didn't have the organizational capacity to do so.
But you know what he had the organizational capacity to do? Was cut off immigration and increase wages.
Yeah, that is controversial. That is deeply, deeply, deeply debatable. The reasons why the Trump economy did well, as we discussed previously, because the Republican Congress allowed him to spend money the way it would never allow Obama to spend money. That is the main reason that the Trump economy did well. There are other things that were happening during the Trump administration. I know that there are people who will swear up and down that the main thing that really mattered was the deregulation that Donald Trump did, which is honestly kind of hard for me to point to, but it's too boring a question to investigate deeply. And it's an article of faith, and an article of faith I just don't have the time or energy to debunk. So maybe deregulation helped. The question of immigration, there are a lot of studies from a lot of economists who will tell you that large-scale migration into the United States is not only not bad for the poorer Americans, but it's actually great and a net benefit for the poorer Americans. And I gotta say, that kind of sounds like bull to me. You know, like I am sure that in the aggregate, I have no question in my mind that like ongoing massive immigration to the United States is an economic boom to the United States in general. But as to this smaller point that What If Altist is making there, as a second or third component of what was happening during the Trump administration, like far after the fact that Republicans allowed him to spend much more money, was the Trump squelching of many forms of immigration good for low-income Americans? Maybe. I think that's possible. I think that's totally possible. And I don't really trust all the economists who, you know, have sworn up and down that actually, no, it doesn't matter. Because these are the same economists that are saying that all this unfettered trade relations with China is just 100% great and hunky-dory for America. And of course, you know, it's kind of hard for me to understand the 2016 election, if that's true. So maybe, but like immigration comes, all I'm saying here is maybe. I sometimes think that if I ever finish this American Empire book, the next thing I will do is the border and immigration for a year or two, because I've never felt like I've adequately understood it. And I've kind of felt like everybody discussing it has an agenda rather than interest in actually understanding it. Certainly, Donald Trump and What If Altist's agenda is towards demonizing migrants who are the backbone of the United States. It is a country of immigrants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're wrong, that at some marginal way, in addition to other factors, shutting down migration might have helped low-income Americans. I don't know. So,
but did immigration increase under Trump?
It did not.
Okay, did it go? So that it definitely went down under him?
It did not. See, well, this is just, this gets to the very, just the cursed difficulty of understanding what migration is. So illegal immigration under Trump cratered. It absolutely did. His messaging was effective. His, like, you know, worshipful description of Border Patrol people and, you know, wanting them to be as bloody as possible or whatever, that worked. Like, it, like, people just did stop coming during some years of the Trump administration. Not entirely, but like there was, and also there was the dynamic that people had already stopped coming before COVID, the financial crisis, large scale migration from Mexico. There's a great clip I've got from one of the most rabidly anti-immigrant people in the United States saying there's just nobody left in Mexico to come. So it was part of a trend that it was already present during the Obama administration. But even from the low Obama era figures, the illegal migration figures dried up more significantly under Trump. Legal migration is, I think, by far a much larger contribution to migrants to the United States. Like how many, you know, supposedly there's 11 million illegal immigrants who've just, you know, been here since the 90s, or does that number fluctuate? Nobody really knows.
Well, yeah, because it's a sort of unknown. It's like a
yeah,
black
it's an
market.
Estimate. Yeah, it's an estimate that at this point a generation of political figures have treated like it's real. My understanding is that the United States lets in, like, I think naturalizes somewhere along the lines of 1 million people a year.
Okay.
Or maybe it's lower than that. You know, they become U.S. citizens after having been here for quite some time and gone through an incredibly elaborate process that can, in some cases, take decades.
But I think America, to its credit, is still very welcoming to immigrants. Like, I think quite often on the news, we only see the sort of negative side of things, but it is still one of the most welcoming to immigrants, you know, in the world.
Yes. So Donald Trump, illegal migration dried up. Legal migration is something that took a lot more effort to stem, but the Trump administration worked very hard on that.
But I think it still went up. Just I'm looking at, is it the Migration Policy Institute? And according to their figures, it still went up under his time, but it has shot up even more under Biden.
Well, they tried very hard. And during the COVID year, they were actually rather quite successful in shutting down legal and illegal migration to a point where I was quite worried as to whether it would be, you know, possible to recover. And it does seem that legal migration under Biden has largely recovered, which I'm very happy to see. But like, so basically, this is an incredibly complex question that What If Altist is boiling down to a very brief, very...
less immigrant good.
Yes, that I think is not... that I can't, I mean, it's, I can't dismiss it as easily as I can dismiss 8 of 10 of the other things he says here, because it's just too complicated to parse in, you know, less than 8 hours
but
of
what
discussion.
What isn't complicated is reindustrialization. And that has definitely happened under Trump.
This is my favorite of all of the entire list, as I point out in the video that is already up. If you'll read that whole section for number 8, what he says is reindustrialization, which has taken off since, which is pretty magical because
famously America doesn't make anything.
Well, no, reindustrialization has taken off since Biden became president. Like, it's under the Biden administration. So, like, Donald Trump definitely talked about this. You can make a case that he changed the climate of discussion or climate of opinion around this. But it's Joe Biden that has actually put, there was a big bipartisan infrastructure act. There was the CHIPS Act. There was the...
did the Green Infrastructure Act not implement a lot of this?
Yes. Do you not like to call it the IRA?
I just forgot the name, to be fair, but I'll call it the IRA if you want.
We did not. No, man. I would be entirely... it would be entirely appropriate for you to not want to call it the IRA. I was going to say the Inflation Reduction Act is the green, but I think just calling it the green bill, actually, you know, and you know, I guess, isn't there some affiliation between green and the IRA anyway, right?
Yes. It also came out with when they were doing weapons trades of Libya, it was referred to as the Green Alliance.
Oh, wow. My God.
But no, I don't think the provisional IRA have much to do with this Inflation Reduction Act.
They do not, though. It is hard for me to not think that this is, in some ways, Biden, an old school East Coast machine politician, having a little joke at the British, at the expense of the British. The Inflation Reduction Act also, I've actually seen some indication that the Inflation Reduction Act may, in fact, be spending vastly more money on green projects than was expected, particularly healthy for the budget. I haven't dived in on that, but that's interesting. It's nice to see that money being spent on green projects rather than aircraft carriers. So the reindustrialization of the United States is to some extent happening, to some debatable extent, and it has taken off since Joe Biden became president. It had very little to do with Donald Trump, and it's quite amusing that he's attempting to credit that.
But he did unify Europe against China and the Russians.
As I pointed out in the video, the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment, the CAI, is an agreement, a long negotiated agreement between Europe and China along the lines of a bilateral free trade agreement, except it is between the entire EU and China. And that was signed in December of 2020 as a parting FU to Donald Trump.
But I think there is also just sort of a fear that America might do something mad. So Europe and China can sometimes just be like, let's just make sure we work okay.
Well, what's interesting is that the CAI has not actually come into effect because China screwed up. Because of the wolf warrior hogwash that they were doing. I think Europe put in some kind of Xinjiang-related sanctions. China decided to sanction, I think, a bunch of European parliamentarians. So Europe was like, yeah, we're not signing a free trade agreement with you if our parliamentarians are being sanctioned. So, you know, F off. But if Donald Trump had still been president, like, maybe they would have made it work.
Okay.
So the point here is that relations between Europe and the United States had fallen so low during the Trump administration that Europe had gone to, you know, had done most of the preliminary work toward, as you've pointed out, that the negotiation of these agreements takes decades. Europe had done that work to essentially align itself economically with China.
And also the war with Ukraine hadn't happened yet, so Europe was still trading a lot with Russia at the time.
Oh, yeah. The gas
and all
pipelines
these,
were...
Yeah, Nord Stream and stuff, like they were, what, a couple of billion? Huge engineering projects.
Donald Trump shouted about Nord Stream a lot, but I don't see how that is successfully rallying Europe against against Russia or China.
Because I know we've talked about before that, you know, America did coax Russia, but it was still ultimately Russia's decision to invade. So a lot of the onus on why Europe doesn't like Russia is because Russia did a horrible thing and it scared Europe.
Europe's unifying against Russia is something that happened in 2022 when Joe Biden was president.
Yes.
Not when Donald Trump was president.
But you can't argue with this one, Rob.
Yeah.
We've had nine and one was nearly, but this is a certain turning Russia against China.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That is definitely something that Donald Trump did. This is a really key thing that a lot of people miss. There are two Donald Trump presidencies, one that does not matter and one that does matter. I don't want to say that, you know, what presidents say does not ever matter because, you know, tremendous turning points in history can be based on presidential messaging, if it's consistent and in a particular direction. However, those turning points are undermined if everything about that president's policy is completely the opposite. Donald Trump has been long castigated for something that I have celebrated him for, which was attempting to derail two runaway freight trains that was U.S.-Russian relations. I've never been a Trump supporter. I really did not like Hillary Clinton, but begrudgingly supported her in 2016 because I disliked Donald Trump so much. But I always liked that he wanted better relations with Russia. It has never been clear to me that the U.S. interest in Ukraine outweighs the U.S. interest in maintaining nuclear agreements with Russia.
But sadly, the, you know, happier and more profitable Russia is, the less likely they would feel the need to invade.
Exactly. So I love that Donald Trump talked about how we needed to get more peaceful with Russia. That's not what his presidency did.
Yeah.
His presidency, I would argue, started open war with Russia. We've talked about this a million times. Russia really cares about its military-industrial complex. Trump signed into law sanctions against Russia that against any country that bought weapons from Russia, which is
a lot of the world.
Existential. But that's an existential threat to Russia. You know, the military-industrial complex in the United States is a small fraction of the U.S. economy. It is a big deal in Russia, and to tell Russia that it can't sell weapons to anybody anymore. I mean, that's like when we told the Japanese we couldn't. You know, they weren't going to get our oil anymore. That was a very serious step towards the Russian invasion of Ukraine that nobody ever acknowledges. We also, under Trump, armed Ukraine to a heavy extent. We also used Ukrainian politics as tissue paper, just like the lack of seriousness of what was meant to be an ongoing peacemaking process between Ukraine and Russia. And Trump decided to make it his sort of plaything for presidential politics and, you know, ended up getting impeached over it. But just the fundamental lack of seriousness with which Donald Trump faced the Russia-Ukraine issue and his fundamental inability to back up any of the nice things he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
There was no turning Russia against China.
But I have some bad news. There's an 11th one that you didn't check.
Oh, yeah?
It says there will be a civil war by the 2024 election, so I'm worried for your safety, Rob.
Yeah, well, you know, for those of you who may listen to the podcast and not check out my YouTube videos, I'm here to tell you that I, at extensive length, a full half hour of YouTube video, produced YouTube video, no less, answering exactly this question, or rather mocking this question. I do not believe. I mean, you know, it's interesting because I find that so laughable, so silly, the idea that the 2024 election would prompt some kind of civil war. I'm not saying that there's no chance of violence, where we are a heavily armed culture with a lot of very stupid people. But the idea of a larger civil war is not just something that what if altist in the weird fever swamps is pushing. It's something that, like, the Atlantic Monthly and a whole lot of the Democratic establishment are pushing. Or not necessarily civil war, but the fall of democracy and just this general panic.
But is there a lot less venom in this campaign compared to the previous one?
Well, I don't think anybody has the energy. I don't think the candidates have the energy.
But that's what I feel. You'd know better than me, but compared to the, you know, Hillary Trump, I feel like this is a bit of two old men are going to slag each other off for a couple more months and one of them will win.
And that's the thing, despite incredible efforts, nobody really hates the Bidens as much as they hated the Clintons.
Yeah, well, he's an old rich white man.
Yeah,
it's hard to get America scared at that.
And the joke is, I haven't followed the Hunter Biden's stuff so much, but it seems like so many of the revelations are that either he's like kind of a sad drug addict that, you know, you feel bad for his father, or that he's just kind of like a hilarious party boy in ways that, like, Donald Trump would like to be viewed.
Yeah, but it's a good thing Trump doesn't have any children that behave in a similar manner.
No, they're just taking billion-dollar bribes from Saudi Arabia. So that's, I guess, better.
So, yes. I don't think he can be. He's just, I don't know, this YouTuber does scare me. I think I was saying that he's like a very bad Ben Shapiro.
Yeah. You know, I had found him interesting in years past because I really did sort of see myself in him a lot, and that he just, like, you're young, you're angry, you're pretty smart, you're searching for a set of answers, and the right wing jumps in with, like, a set of answers that, like, seem very persuasive. And I was wholly persuaded, and, you know, mostly, thankfully, was just beleaguering people with long emails to the tune of fives or tens of people. And unfortunately, this kid is going through this process in front of an audience of hundreds of thousands.
Do you think he believes everything he says, or is it just the fact that it gets a lot of views, so it's like, this is kind of what they want to hear?
I think it's, people can convince themselves to believe anything, Rory. I think that if you are rewarded for a certain view. And it's also social. Like, I do think, like, my sense, I didn't do too much deep research this time around, just because I find the videos much harder to watch now, as he's fallen from much further down the rabbit hole.
It's also strange. He hasn't seemed to have improved. Like, his maps are still as, like, blurry and bad as ever, when there's so many things to produce, you know, quality maps now. Like, if maps is your thing.
Well, I think kind of the DIY nature of it might be some of the appeal, you know?
And oh, adds to it? Okay.
Because, I mean, he's got a large audience. Like, I'm constantly trying to improve because, you know, not enough people are watching, you know? but I think he might be sitting on his laurels a bit. But the sense that I got sort of researching him in earlier years is that he's found his people, and that can almost be worse. Like, I went and worked at some libertarian think tanks and, like, you know, really wanted to, like, get along with these people, and was just like, I don't like these people. They're not, you know. And I was lucky, I guess, in that, like, I didn't find, like, a social affinity with a lot of the people who were in the same ideological lane as I was.
Well, I also worry about that because he keeps talking about how the internet's real. Like, I can see it's real to some extent, but it's almost as if, like, I don't need to engage with the real world because I'm on the internet and look at all of this. There does seem to be a sort of a loneliness in him, the way he talks about the internet.
Oh, deep, deep.
Which I do feel bad for him.
But I do think, the sense that I get is he has been able to travel a little bit. He's got a big platform, so he goes on bigger podcasts, and I think he probably goes to events and meets people. And I think it's been enforcing some of his...
Oh, yeah, because he's only meeting...
Dumber instincts.
The people that already agree with these, you know, viewpoints.
Yeah, to the point where it's like, I don't want to watch another What If All This video, which may come through in the content that I produced.
Yeah, some of his stuff is very worrying.
Yeah, no, it's quite sad. And it just seems less likely, even though he's supposedly still only 22, it seems a lot less likely that he's going to snap out of it. So, there.
Well, we will catch you next time. Well, we will expose the truth, because we have the freedom.
Indeed.
Catch you next time.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is RobOLaw, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.